Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
In this part of the program, we'll be taking up a topic that we have on the show every month, always on a Monday. For a long time, it was the 10 o'clock hour, and just fairly recently, we've made a switch. But it's still the same day of the month. Dr. Suzanne Troopen is with us. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has a practice here in our area. She also teaches at U of I Med School. And once a month, she is here, and we talk about women's health. We thought a long time ago that it would be something there would always be questions about. And certainly there are new things in the news all the time that have to do with women's health. So when the doctor is here, she talks a little bit about things that are new. But also, we have the opportunity for people who are listening to call in and ask questions. And as I have said before, during the time that we've been doing this, we have covered a very wide range of topics. We've talked about contraception and pregnancy and birthing, and we have talked about all of the things that affect women all along their life course, all the way up to subjects like menopause and osteoporosis, for example. And in more general terms, we've talked about all of the things that women can do, particularly women can do, to be more healthy. So that's what's on the agenda here for the program. We'll see what she has in mind talking about. And then if people have questions about that or anything else that has to do with her area of practice, you can call us. 333-9455. That's the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
What would you like to talk about?
Well, I thought I would cover a variety of topics, from endometriosis and sexual dysfunction and some new approved treatments for osteoporosis. I know a lot of our listeners call on that. Mm-hmm. There's some new information regarding pregnancy and what some of the abnormal tests in pregnancy mean. I thought that was cute, but I thought I'd start out with something kind of goofy. So if you look at your hand, David,
yeah.
Is your second finger shorter than your fourth finger?
Is my second finger shorter than my fourth finger? Is it?
Yeah, I would say it is. Uh-huh. That's my diagnosis.
Okay.
And I think
okay.
Most people can make their own diagnosis. And that's considered the male pattern. That's considered male. And many women, their second and fourth finger are identical in length. But if any females have their second finger shorter than their fourth finger, it's supposed to be a subtle sign that of male hormones. Somehow. One new study showed it was out of Australia. We get a lot of research from Australia these days. And they thought that it might be a marker for a group of individuals that might be a little bit more likely to have polycystic ovarian condition and or perhaps a little extra male hormone exposure when they were fetuses, or perhaps just genetic. But anyway, it's a fun little thing that everybody can look at their hands and make their own little diagnosis, go rushing off to their doctors. I wasn't going to say, where did you hear this? But anyway, it was just in the news this week. So I thought, yeah, you can look. So I've been looking at men to see if this is truly the male pattern.
And so,
so far,
yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I thought I would also start talking about endometriosis. It's a chronic gynecologic condition. It's probably the most common condition that causes pelvic pain. And we think that it's most commonly first occurring in women in their teen years. But the average onset of diagnosis, the length of time between the start of symptoms and diagnosis is often 9 years, which is kind of amazing. And primarily because endometriosis is a condition where the glands from the lining of the uterus get implanted in the internal abdominal area, so either on the back of the uterus or on the fallopian tubes or on the ovaries. And this condition can produce pain, just general low pelvic pressure pain, pain at the time of ovulation, pain with intercourse, and painful periods. And because it's internal, the primary accurate way to make a diagnosis has always been a laparoscopy and actual surgery. And because the surgical way of diagnosis is fairly common, many people have only been treated with surgery. And so they go in, their physician looks, they see some endometriosis, and then they either take a laser or cautery to actually burn or a knife to actually cut and just treat it surgically. And unfortunately, because it's such a common condition, often I'll see patients on referral that have been have undergone these surgeries multiple times. And surgery does give relief to patients from their various pain symptoms for a short period of time, but it doesn't seem to last. And most of us think that's because there's probably areas of endometriosis that we can't see. Even at the time of surgery, we're using magnification, quite a bit of magnification, to look internally to see if we are missing any endometriosis. But still, you can imagine that if you could use even more magnification, maybe you'd see other areas. And they've done studies where they've gone in and specifically done biopsies on women who have endometriosis, but specifically done the biopsies in areas that don't appear to have endometriosis. And some of those areas are positive for endometriosis. So over time, we've developed a few treatments. Birth control pills have been used as a treatment and works a little bit. We have used injections, and recently the Depo-Provera contraception injection was approved at a lower dose for long-term treatment of endometriosis, and actually it's designed so patients can self-inject, which is new, so they don't have to make so many trips to the doctor's office if they would choose to self-inject a few times a year, and that's been a big benefit. We have other injectables, GnRH, a medicine called Lupron that puts a woman into menopause to treat endometriosis. But unfortunately, many of these treatments have a recurrence rate of about a 40% to 50%. In other words, half of the patients have their symptoms back 6 months after they stopped their treatment. And almost somewhere between 70 and 90% of patients have some symptoms back a year after they stopped their treatment. So most of the research in endometriosis is going towards, number one, finding a better treatment, and number two, finding a treatment that is such that you can stay on these treatments for long periods of time. The Lupron medication is really only recommended for 6 months of treatment. So for somebody that gets a condition in their teens to early 20s and is faced with probably having this condition to some extent or another until she goes through menopause, 6 months or a year or even a couple of years of treatment may not be near enough. So there's just been a lot of exciting research in all kinds of different types of treatments for endometriosis. And actually, our office is working on two different research studies right now, looking for women who still have chronic pain from endometriosis. And we're pretty excited about it. Endometriosis trials are difficult to do. As you can imagine, they're looking for women who have pain, and yet mostly the FDA requires that we do two groups, so one group getting the medicine and one group not getting the medicine, but only getting pain medicine management. So lots of patients aren't willing to participate in research like that because they want to get the medicine.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And many patients just have no... I think there's been more news about the whole drug approval process, and especially there's, you know, all the time in the news, there's things about drugs that were studied and approved, and then we have still issues with them. And most of that just serves to push the whole drug approval process back to even longer, not shorter. But it's extraordinarily long process. And you hear snippets about exciting new medicines years before they're actually available to patients.
Yeah. That's something that we have talked about on and off over the years. And I think that, as I recall it, the number one explanation for what causes endometriosis has to do with somehow uterine tissue, the tissue from the uterine lining, instead of being fleshed out the way that it's supposed to at the time a woman has a period, ends up somehow getting – Either it goes up the fallopian tubes, or it somehow it gets into places where it's not supposed to be. And then what it happens is it implants there, and then as women's hormone cycle, it acts like uterine lining does, and it bleeds, and it causes a lot of problems, particularly if it gets into the abdominal cavity or other places we're not supposed to be. And that seems sort of like to be the standard number one explanation, except that that apparently is not really a very good explanation, or at least you think maybe partly that's what's going on, but it doesn't explain the whole phenomenon.
Well, it doesn't explain the whole phenomenon, definitely, for a lot of different reasons. For instance, some endometriosis occurs within the wall of the uterus. So how did that get there? Mm-hmm. Didn't get flushed anywhere. And some endometriosis gets to very remote parts of the body. And it's a little bit more easy to imagine something getting, say, to the rectal area, but there have been cases of endometriosis in the lung and in the brain, I mean, very remote parts of the body. So certainly that tissue probably transmigrated through blood vessels or lymph gland channels, something like that. But we also think that it must have something to do with our own immune capabilities. And we think that if that tissue gets into the abdomen, our bodies are set up to send some cleanup cells to clean that out of there. And yet, if the cleanup cells either aren't functioning correctly, so immune problem, or maybe not as competent, they call it, as it could be, or they get overwhelmed, perhaps that's the reason then the condition of endometriosis develops. And we think that there are lots of ways that we can enhance our own immune system. I know people come in all the time and say, how do I change my diet to prevent endometriosis? And we don't really think you can truly change your diet to prevent endometriosis. But like with other diseases, like even resolution of human papillomavirus and prevention of other cancers or prevention of cancers and various other kinds of conditions, we think anything you do to physiologically boost your immune system helps. And with that, we think that antioxidants are very, very important. And we think that those omega-3 fatty acids, I know we've talked a lot about those, are very important. And they're very high in fish oil. And most of us just don't eat enough fish. And even if we tried to eat a lot more fish, there's the question of how much mercury can you ingest. Although a local University of Illinois professor told me that you could easily have 100 times the recommended mercury level safely, and he doesn't believe that data. But I would go with the recommendations myself, and we're very careful about that in pregnancy. So we think that having fish oil supplementation is very important. And fish oil capsules can taste a little fishy, even the capsules, if you try them. There's actually a new prescription vitamin for women that just came out on the market. And they haven't specifically studied it with respect to any particular condition, but it's very high in fish oil. It has very high level, much higher levels of folic acid. I think it's got 2.5 milligrams, where we recommend for pregnancy planning moms to have 0.4. So this has, you know, more than five times the amount of folic acid, which is also supposed to be good for heart disease prevention. So anything you can do to improve your immune system probably helps to overall prevent endometriosis. And then also the use of continuous birth control pills rather than letting yourself have the 400 periods or something like that that we're destined to have in modern times, because we don't have as many children. And if we do, we don't breastfeed as long or as consistently to help prevent our menses. And so anything you can do to prevent yourself from having periods apparently helps prevent endometriosis as well.
Yeah. Okay. Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She has practice here in the area, teaches U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign. And once a month, always on a Monday, she's here. We talk about women's health. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. We did have a question here. Someone called in asking their question off the air and was interested in your view of the use of antidepressants to treat hot flashes.
Well, that's a very good question. What she means is the use of medicines that are in the category of SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, and basically they have been studied. The medication Prozac's been studied the most, but several of the others have actually been studied, and they definitely work versus placebo. If we look at hot flash studies, and I have one of these trials enrolling, these are a little bit tough to do also, but when we look at these hot flash studies, within the first 4 weeks, we get somewhere between a 20 and 40% placebo effect in the placebo group. Mind over matter, it's always tough. That's why PMS studies are almost impossible to do, because we get such an extraordinarily high placebo effect that it's really tough to make sure that your medicine's better than the fake. But definitely with hot flash, over time, that placebo effect actually mitigates significantly. And so within about 4 weeks, a significant percentage of patients are responding over the placebo. And after about 12 weeks is when we see pretty consistent response. And what you get is probably where you're going to be. And probably 80% of patients are relieved at least significantly or completely of their hot flashes. When we look at the SSRIs, they tend to perform worse. So in between placebo and hormones. And generally speaking, hormones are just significantly outperform the SSRIs. But SSRI use for hot flashes is important in people who cannot take hormone therapy, women with a current estrogen-dependent cancer that primarily is people with, say, an active breast or uterine cancer. Once uterine cancers have been treated, you certainly can take estrogen. But women who, for whatever other medical reason, maybe blood clotting situations or heart, blood pressure, those kinds of patients, patients with active liver disease, those patients cannot take estrogen hormones, and we think about using SSRIs. We now also have this whole class of drugs called the SERMs, the selective estrogen receptor modulators, and probably the best known one is a drug called Avista. And I've seen some of their television commercials, so maybe some of the listeners have too. It's a medicine called raloxifene that's used for the prevention and treatment of osteoporosis. But in early use, this particular SERM can actually produce some hot flashes or worsen pre-existing hot flashes. Usually that effect goes away over time, and so it shouldn't be a reason everybody should avoid it by any means, but it's a very good medicine. But now we're getting into another generation of SERMs that act like estrogen on certain parts of the body and anti-estrogen on others. With this drug, raloxifene, I've talked about it before, being studied as a possible anti-breast cancer strategy. And they're comparing it with another SERM, tamoxifen, that's been used for treatment of breast cancer to help prevent cancers. But now we have a class of SERMs that might also do other positive estrogen things. And I haven't so far started looking at one that would specifically treat hot flashes, but I know of two SERMs in development that are being used as alternatives for treatment of vaginal atrophy, vaginal dryness, the changes in the whole genital vaginal area that women get over time if they don't take estrogen. So it's SERM use is used as an alternative to estrogen for treatment of hot flashes, and now we're moving into an era looking at these other things that estrogen is designed to treat in menopause and coming up with some alternatives.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let me just mention our telephone numbers again if we're certainly interested in questions from people who are listening. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. You have questions for our guest, Dr. Suzanne Trubin. What else would you like to talk about?
I was saying that there are quite a few new treatments for osteoporosis. There were two that were just newly FDA approved, and then That was in the literature that isn't yet FDA approved, but I thought I would talk about it in context. So of the medication for osteoporosis, Beneva, that is a once-a-month treatment. It's been advertised a lot. So it's a bisphosphonate. It's a cousin of the medicines Actonel and Fosamax. And now they have just approved a once-every-four-month treatment that is an intravenous infusion. It takes about 15 to 30 seconds to get your medicine, and boom, you're done for the next 4 months. And it was found to be as effective in terms of protecting your bone density as the once a day formulation of Beneva, which the once a month was tested against as well. So that was just recently approved again. The process takes a little bit, and exactly when it'll be on the shelf for physicians, I'm not sure, but that was exciting.
Yeah. Well, then I think we've had questions about this before. I think the problem with these medicines like Fosamax is they can cause a lot of real gastric problems.
Exactly.
And so that's I'm assuming that's why it is we're looking for formulations that go from taking it every day to maybe taking it once a week or taking it once a month, or so the fewer times that you have to take it, then you reduce that nasty
side effect. And if you take it intravenously, you bypass the GI tract altogether.
So
but
you don't,
yes.
with that way of administering it, then you don't have the same problem?
Those gastric side effects are extremely uncommon with that.
Okay. We have some other callers here lined up and ready to go. Let's talk with them, and we'll go next and talk with someone in Champaign. This is line number one. Hello.
Yes. I was curious. I am in my early 60s, and in the last year have begun to have more skin breaking out, almost like I did when I was a teenager. Not a lot, but just
a little bit of acne.
Chronic, yes.
Acne. Well, it could be caused by a variety of conditions, but it also can be caused by a change in balance between the types of hormones in your body, so that we continue to make male hormone and we don't have so much estrogen hormone in our body, and that balance may be affecting things. Also, our estrogen, when we're younger, helps the liver produce SHBG. And SHBG is a carrier protein for hormones like testosterone. And when we don't have so much SHBG, what little male hormone we have in our system can get to our skin, and it can get broken down to more active forms, and it might be contributing to that. Now, there are other causes as well, but it's not uncommon in menopause to revisit the acne.
Okay. Is there anything that can be taken?
Most people do not try treating it hormonally unless there were other reasons that they had to go on the hormones, sometimes topical applications. But usually a strategy of seeing your healthcare provider and getting a typical acne regimen is usually what we try, presuming that is exactly what it is.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you to McLean County for our next caller. This is line four. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have several questions, but I'm going to keep them as short as possible, or at least go to the top two, and then we will see. You were talking about IV or shots for in place of Beneva.
Okay.
Could you give me the name of it? Because I have IBS, I'm trying Beneva, but every time I get to thinking, am I doing it on a Saturday, I wake up and for some reason I have GI pain and I won't try it. So,
well, the medication is Beneva. The intravenous is Beneva. It's the same medicine, but it's administered differently. But it's not quite available to physicians' offices yet. But also, there are a variety of other treatments for osteoporosis, including the nasal calcitonin, which you sniff.
Doesn't work for me. I'm sorry. Keep going. And I mean, because maybe there's something I haven't heard that you.
And it's important to remember that we're talking about the big global topics.
Right.
And when you have a specific condition, you probably either need to work with a specialist, that sort of thing. You need to step back, figure out, What are your vitamin D levels? Do you have adequate calcium? All the kinds of pieces that lead up to good bone health, as well as what your specific medicine is. And there's a whole new way to approach treating treating bones that we're moving into. But I know a lot of different groups are studying this and they haven't all agreed. But basically, I like to use a grid where you look at age relative to what your T-score is and then also think about other factors that might not specifically be on that grid and do rough calculations of your 10-year fracture risk and then base actual medical therapy on that. And young people, women 50, 55, 60, all those youths out there, many of them can use non-medication strategies until their percent chance of risk gets high enough with their scores and their age.
Okay. Next question, and then I'll stop because I don't want to take up too much of your time. You're talking about fish oil and, or basically ways to improve immune system. What kind of fish oil do you recommend and how much in terms of what should I look for?
The best way to approach it is they're mostly labeled fish oil capsules, and you can get them over the counter. As I said, there's this new medication that has a very high content that's a vitamin. It's actually, I've looked at the packages, there's actually four pills that you swallow, two in the morning and two in the evening.
Wow.
And many fish oil capsules are big. But they're sold pretty much everywhere. Many products have them.
So I'm just looking for fish oil.
Pretty much.
Capsules. And probably
you could always go to a health food store or a local pharmacy. Many national chain pharmacists can even come out and point out what on their over the counter products people are talking about.
Okay. Well, see, there are too many products, and I'm wondering because I also hear in the news sometimes about some of the generic things, are they worthwhile? Do they really have, because they're not FDA controlled, whether they have enough of whatever they say they have? That's what, maybe if there's something.
This is a little bit different, and it is sold as a food, and there now is a prescription item available.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, well, thanks for the call. Let's continue here, and we'll talk next with someone in Urbana, and this is a caller on our line number two. Hello.
Hello. On the topic of fish oil, I saw something which I hadn't heard before. In the latest issue of the Johns Hopkins Medical Letter, there's an article on vitamin D, the bone builder, and it at the very end it says, avoid cod liver oil. It's very rich in this vitamin D. You could overdose, particularly if you're taking supplements. And it also says cod liver oil also contains high levels of vitamin A, which can weaken bones. Now, I'd never heard that.
The vitamin A weaken bone literature is not strong. And there were a number of articles, and then there were a number of other articles that that have had contradictory, looked at it and not found those associations. But still, vitamin A is a vitamin that you can't overdose. And vitamin D is a vitamin that we have told patients in the past to worry about, that we can't overdose. But all my recent information talks about extraordinarily high levels of vitamin D intake that are perfectly safe and possibly beneficial, particularly to bones. Vitamin D is something that can be measured in your bloodstream, fairly simple blood test at your primary care doctor. And I think I've talked about this before in some of my research trials, trying to look at patients that were interested in going into osteoporosis trials or prevention of osteoporosis trials, and we do vitamin D. I was surprised that a lot of my basically healthy patients, about 10 to 15% in a couple of trials that we were running, didn't qualify based on their vitamin D. So you're right. Products like cod liver oil can contain much higher levels of things, and it's something to consider in the mix. But generally, we tell people not to worry about their vitamin D intake and vitamin A, as long as you stay within the recommended guidelines. It's good for you. Good for your vision, night vision especially.
Thank you.
Let's go to Champagne, and this is line number one. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I am a postmenopausal woman in her late 50s, and I've taken HRT for a number of years with a lapse right after the women's health study results came out. But I resumed it because of insomnia and mainly that. I was okay with the hot flashes, but I couldn't sleep at night. So I went on a low dose, and that's what I'm on right now, 0.3 Prempro. My question is, just in the past month and a half, I would say, I'm getting what I would call night flashes, not night sweats, but like just sort of a heating up of the body, and it wakes me up. And there is some accompanying insomnia. Any thoughts on that?
Well, as always, you pretty much need to sit down with your primary health care provider and make sure that nothing else is going on. There are other endocrine disorders that can produce issues. There are, you know, if your blood pressure fluctuates, things like that, there are other medical conditions that can be associated. And of course, you'd want to be checked out and not just assume that it's relative to your hormone therapy. We think that the Women's Health Initiative taught us a few things. Number one, short-term hormone replacement therapy use is perfectly safe. Number two, if you take older women, meaning in the Women's Health Initiative study, their average age of entry was 63 years old, or the average age of patient in that trial was 63 years old. If you take older individuals and suddenly now introduce hormone therapy, we know that the risks are greater than what we thought in the past, meaning more cases of pulmonary embolism, more cases of blood clots, more cases of heart attacks. We still showed fracture prevention and other benefits, but as we get older, the risk-benefit ratio does change. So the new mantra, without giving a four-hour lecture here, David would long leave. But the new mantra of most gynecologists is the lowest effective dose for the shortest amount of time. And most of the research trials that I'm involved with in treating menopausal patients are specifically looking at that exactly. Can we get the effectiveness in terms of bone health and protection against hot flashes and treatment of the vulvovaginal atrophy. And I'm sort of getting to your case, but can we get this same benefit with these lower doses? And the medication that you've mentioned is, in fact, the lowest available combination conjugated estrogen, medroxyprogesterone, known as Prempro, one of the most, still the most common combined hormonal therapy out there. And can we treat these conditions effectively with these lower doses? And most of the research tells us, yes, we can. Most of the research says that doesn't mean that every woman can be effectively treated with the lowest possible dose, and that we take a year-by-year approach now in terms of what are your symptoms and is there some reason why your hormone therapy needs to be modulated. The Premarin capsule itself is fairly thick. And when they look at digestion of it, there have been some studies that say that some patients don't quite get the same blood levels as other women get, and that sometimes changing products or changing dose is all that's needed to effectively treat the symptoms that you used to be getting treated for.
Okay. Could I ask one more question?
Yeah, sure.
If I decide to go off hormone therapy, is it better to wean off of it? Or when I went off last time, you know, I just quit, and actually the no symptoms set in for about 6 months, no hot, daytime hot flashes or any problem with sleeping, but eventually it did happen. I don't have any hot flashes during the day, but I just have this little night thing going on. And so if I would decide to quit,
usually that's something that you want to sit down and talk to your healthcare provider before you just toss the package in the garbage. And generally, we think that getting down to a low dose, which you have done, but, you know, other women out there listening may have not, generally tapering off the dose seems to be an easier, gentler way of accommodating the symptoms. But what you need to do is sit there and say, okay, if I am taking this prescribed medication, what am I treating? If I'm going to stop this prescribed medication, what sort of monitoring do I need? And what other treatments am I going to use so that I'm not going to have those symptoms? And what's going to happen to my sex drive, to my sexuality, to my bladder, to my bones, so forth and so on, not just this hot flash and sleeping piece.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Sorry. We are talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She has practice here in the area. She teaches at the U of I Med School, and once a month she is here. It's always on a Monday we talk about women's health, and she usually comes prepared to talk about a few things that are new going on in her field, but also we are open to questions, and I know she'll do her best to help you out if you want to give us a call. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. 800-222-9455. And another caller here. This is someone in Champaign, line two. Hello.
Yes. I have heard recently some speculation about whether hormones that are used in animal production could possibly be responsible for apparently an earlier onset of puberty, especially in girls. Do you know of any research about that?
Well, it is true that the beef industry particularly has used hormones to boost both milk production and to boost the overall size of their cows so they produce more meat and so forth. And these hormones in some of these animals' products are somewhat detectable, albeit very, very low levels. For instance, we are exposed to other kinds of estrogens, not just from beef. We know that, for instance, soy has plant estrogens, and we know that certain greens, like alfalfa, for instance, has certain plant estrogens as well. And many pesticides have some estrogenic ability provoking chemical features as well. So there's more than just these hormones that are used in animal productions that expose us to hormones. So you have to take it in the whole context. We don't think that that probably is the deciding factor in earlier puberty. It seems that we do have earlier puberty. It probably was around the age of 14 many, many, many years ago, and probably around the turn of the century, puberty was probably around 13. And I think it was hovering at about 12, and I think it's trending down, 12 years old. And I think it for girls, I don't follow it as much for the boys, so I can't tell you the exact age. But we think that that has to do more with nutrition and overall size. And it seems to be the overall weight gain. We used to say, you'll get your period at 100 pounds. And, you know, in rough numbers, that's not an unusual that's a reasonable number to use. But so your overall height, your overall weight, and your overall fat has really been shown to correlate with age of puberty. And I'm sure you've read that our children's population is getting increased numbers of children that have a weight problem. And we think that that body fat percentage is factoring into why we have an earlier puberty as well.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. I know one of the things that we have talked about is the fact that, say, if you have intensely competitive female athletes, if they get their body fat down below a certain point, they will stop having periods.
Or never start.
I suppose if you're in something like if you're a gymnast or something,
correct,
and you've started when you're 6 years old and you've intensely competed all that time, then maybe then it's actually possible that you would not start having periods.
Correct.
And that has to do with body fat. So
probably,
Partly.
Of course, intensely trained athletes have two or three other things going on, and they have stress hormones that are produced, and they may have other hormonal reasons that they don't ovulate or have their whole ovary. We call it the HPO axis, the hypothalamus, the pituitary, and the ovary, HPO. Everything in medicine actually has a nickname. You ask a doctor anything, they're spewing initials at you. But we think that there are a number of hormones that can actually suppress that. But we see it very regularly, like a ballerina, for instance, when she's in her intense training and a time when she's on stage, she might not have a period. Then she may go into a time where her training isn't so intense. They don't tend to gain weight. Those, you know, they're controlling their eating, but their periods might come back. Hmm. So it's a little bit more than body fat, but that's a big, definitely a part of it.
So that, although I think this is the first time I had heard someone mention it, you heard you say or anyone say that with this, the trending down of the age of girls having their first period, that in addition to the whole nutritional issue, that it may have to do with the fact that we're getting kids who are maybe a little bit having more weight than they should, having more fat, body fat is
right.
Going
and
up.
It's just a combination of things. We know that muscle burns more calories than fat. So, as you get heavier, it's even tougher to maintain that percentage.
Let's talk with someone else. This is also Champagne, line one. Hello.
Yes.
Yes, go ahead.
I have a question for Dr. Pruden, but I don't know if that question's been already asked. I kind of came late to the program. Can she comment on the relative frequency of hysterectomies of the types that are, laparoscopically assisted and vaginal, abdominal, and then fully laparoscopic? What is the practice these days in terms of what the patients ask or what the doctors recommend in the area? Because my wife may be a candidate for a hysterectomy, and we want to know about the three types that I've been told are most frequent.
Okay. Absolutely. There are these three general categories. So one...
May I hang up now?
Oh, sure. Thanks for the call.
And one is vaginal hysterectomy. In other words, all the operating is performed through the vagina, so there's no cuts on the abdomen. Usually the cervix is removed first, and then the attachments to the uterus are removed. And whether or not you take the ovaries or not, it's really a separate discussion than the type of hysterectomy. And most physicians, if the indication is prolapse or the uterus is small, most gynecologists that do frequent hysterectomies feel comfortable in those situations doing a vaginal procedure. As the uterus gets bigger, like in the condition of uterine fibroids, which is a very common reason for hysterectomy, as the uterus gets bigger, then it becomes very physician dependent. And there are some of us who are much older. Not old, but older. And we've trained in the era where we do these procedures called morcellation, which technically means that we can take the uterus out in sections. And many of us can safely and accomplish these vaginal hysterectomies, say, in the 90 to 95% time with increasingly larger uteri is the correct term. So as the uterus gets larger, though, for some surgeons, it becomes beyond their capability and they have to move to a different type of surgery. And very often that has meant then moving to an abdominal procedure. And the abdominal procedures essentially just mean that there's an incision made in the abdominal wall such that the abdomen is opened and all the operating takes place in essentially an open abdomen. And for large uteruses or uteruses with certain types of cancers where you have to sample lymph nodes, something like that, usually most of those cases are done abdominally. And there's just an operator-dependent sort of line between what cases you recommend vaginally versus abdominally. So it's not often always, it is a choice, but it's often what your own surgeon is recommending is best in your case for whatever reason. Now, we've developed an era of laparoscopic assisted hysterectomies, and this might be the laparoscope might assist just in terms of looking in, making sure there's no reason the surgery can't be accomplished vaginally, and then doing the entire procedure vaginally, or doing almost every step until you remove the uterus through the laparoscope. Again, how many of the steps are done is a little bit operator dependent. Why this would be accomplished instead of an abdominal surgery, it can essentially, it can give you the advantages of a vaginal surgery without the big incision in your abdomen, because mostly there's three or four very tiny incisions on the order of about a quarter inch that are done. Some of the laparoscopic assisted procedures are technically more difficult for some surgeons to learn. And so some surgeons don't do very many, and other surgeons do a lot of them because they don't do as much vaginal surgery. And some surgeons who are really good at vaginal surgery don't need the laparoscopic assist. So again, it's pretty much a case where your surgeon would probably have a strong preference in a particular medical scenario, and they would probably then explain to you why one route or the other would be necessary in your individual case or your wife's case. I think it was a male call, not your case, but hopefully the collective you.
Yeah, we have maybe 3-4 minutes left. Is there anything else that you'd
well,
like to
I was going to go back to the issue about acne and skin and a couple of the other questions about hormone replacement therapy, and it kind of triggered my mind regarding the effects of estrogen on our skin are actually fairly dramatic, and they've done some fascinating studies regarding biopsying women's skin and collagen content when they were on estrogen versus off of estrogen, and actually looking at wrinkling in women on and off estrogen. And the effects of estrogen on your skin are actually fairly dramatic. And we're actually having a lecture on that. I'd forgotten when we were discussing. One of my nurses is very interested in this topic, and she's going to actually be giving a free public education lecture in our office tomorrow on that subject. I just thought I'd mention it. I thought that I would also talk about the hormone dihydroepiandrosterone sulfate, or DHEA, dihydroepiandrosterone, and it is adrenal hormone. It is a male hormone. It is available over the counter. It's one of those bodybuilding kinds of hormones that gets into a little bit of controversy, but it is used medically as well, and it's often indicated in patients with arthritis. And interestingly enough, they've just done a study in lupus patients. So this information isn't necessarily generalizable, but they've done a study on patients with lupus being given this medication, DHEA, and it is apparently very effective at building bone density in those patients. So I think that this may give us an entirely new pathway to look at of treatment, because as the one caller called in, and she didn't get into depth of her own medical case, but it's not unusual to have patients who need treatment to either prevent or treat osteoporosis who've already not been successful with a lot of the medications out there, because all of them do have their side effects.
Mm-hmm. Anything else that you want to
Yes, let's see. I was going to also, I think when I started, I said I was going to talk a little bit about female sexual dysfunction. There are two different categories of female sexual dysfunction. One is HSDD and one is FSAD. And HSDD stands for hyperactive sexual desire disorder. So just a lower libido overall. And FSAD stands for female sexual arousal disorder. And with both of these conditions, there have not yet been approved treatments for them. And there's a whole new avenue in evaluating and treating female sexual disorders that's starting to evolve. You know, men have about a half a dozen drugs that they can get prescribed. So we're a little bit behind. We don't have any medications that are indicated to improve our sexual function or desire. But we're starting to look into that. I'm getting involved in some studies, so I'm kind of excited about that. But one of the most important issues for most physicians is that we've now studied it enough and are starting to classify these disorders so that if women go in and talk to their primary health care providers, which they certainly should, or their obstetrician gynecologist, they can get an actual firm diagnosis, which will help them, therefore, lead towards therapy in the future.
Okay. Well, perhaps at that, we will leave it for this time around with our thanks to our guest, Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She has a practice here in our area in Champaign-Urbana. She also teaches at U of I Med School in Urbana-Champaign. And once every month, it's always on a Monday, in the 11 o'clock hour, she is here. We talked a little bit about women's health. She comes and talks about things that are new, but also we give people the opportunity to call in and ask questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.